And it is 9 a.m. in the West Coast. It is 12 noon in the East Coast, and it's 7 p.m. in Jerusalem, the capital of Israel. Today is August 15, 2016, and this is Orly Benny Davis with Impossible Truth. Today we are honored and very happy to have a special guest, a friend, and an expert. He was the director of business development and marketing executive. Well, he's actually still on Armortext. He used to be with the defense. He was with the defense policy advisor and the technology analyst. He was a consultant. He was advisor. He was in our special forces. John Villanueva, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Orly. Thank you for having me. And it's a pleasure being there, and happy to be here.
Thank you so much. Your information is so complicated and so incredible that I had a hard time, trying to repeat even a little of what you are accomplishing in your life. Your work is extraordinary, and your service to the country is amazing. So I'm honored to have you here today, sweetie. Let's go on with the issue that I wanted to talk about today. We have a game, a very interesting game played in the Middle East. You know that we have forces from all countries coming together in Syria, and we're trying to defeat the terrorist organization called ISIS. But right now, there is a game, that you play in the background that we're not sure where it's going to lead to. Try to tell me, what do you think?
Well, this is a really interesting time in our history, right? I mean, you have three big players coming to the table to try to resolve the ongoing civil war in Syria. So you have the Russians, right, who are still suffering the economic blows of low oil and gas prices that has halved their economic GDP, most of which they blame on the United States because they feel that we're orchestrating these low oil prices in order to hurt them. You have Erdogan in Turkey, who recently survived the coup, who until last month, right, he was at odds with both the Russians and Israel. And then you have Iran that recently negotiated somewhat of a truce in suspending their nuclear program with the United States, and is trying to re-enter the world stage as a credible nation, right? One that is not hostile to its neighbors. And
Right.
all three have come together, basically facilitated by Iran, saying, we think we can bring about a resolution to the crisis in Syria. You know, wow.
However, we have us the Saudis that we have to remember, because the Saudi have a position. They are not going to keep Assad in, because the conflict is a Shiite and Sunni, as you know, and the Sunnis are not going to give up their position against the ruler of Syria right now. But the tricky position that Russia is taking is defending Syria in one end and making a deal, economic, a strategic economic deal with Turkey at this time, when NATO, which we all are the alliances against the invasion of Russia, are in position in Turkey. Turkey is a part of NATO, and you cannot have Russian forces in Turkey while we have NATO. It's a conflict, about to happen. What do you think we should do?
That's right. We're going to have to deconflict this, right? I mean, because there are
Right.
some real dangers here. The
Right.
Russians are running bombing raids in Aleppo against anti-Assad forces. The U.S. is actually supporting some of those anti-Assad forces. And we have both, Russian and U.S. operatives operating in the region. And at any time, there could be, some type of miscommunication or a mishap in which casualties are inflicted by the U.S. on Russia or Russia on the U.S. And that would, in fact, be a game changer. But
Right.
here's the reality we have to accept, and that is that the United States has not had a lot of success bringing about a resolution in Syria. And our battle against ISIS pits us against most of the countries that are dominated or ruled by Sunni regimes in the Middle East. The Iran and Russia both do not want to see Assad go. And the U.S. and Turkey, on the other hand, would like to see Assad out of power. And so that's a point of contention. The reality is that at this point in time, if Assad, if we can come to a resolution whereby Assad stays or there's some type of peaceful transition into the future, then it may be possible for both Russia, Iran, and Turkey to come to bring to the table some type of resolution that stabilizes the situation in Syria and at the same time allows us to focus our energies on ISIS rather than Assad.
I know, but in this solution, we are giving a win to a victory to Iranian, Russian, Turkey alliances when the Saudis are not gonna, agree upon that. And the Kurds are the losing proposition in that because the Turks don't want the PKK be a part of the southern border of Turkey. You have to understand, Turkey has a few argument with the world right now. She wants to, Erdogan wants to rule Turkey as he wish because he kicked out everybody. The coup just gave him a provision to dismantle the all democratic system. Then he brings the Russian forces inside instead of NATO because he's arguing that it's economical strategy. And then he make a position that he wants the Kurds out of the way, which is dangerous because they are pre-American forces. They are helping us. And he has another condition. He's not going to tolerate the immigrants if the European Union is not going to give them the visa or the right to travel freely in Europe. You see, he's trying to hold everybody hostage to his wish, and nobody is coming to the plate. And I expect really the United States to come to the plate and say, you guys have to understand that NATO is not going to let Turkey become a dictatorial place. Am I right?
Well, Erdogan, right? I mean, the coup, the failure of the coup last month is the death blow to Ataturkism, right? Erdogan has effectively dismantled Ataturkism and the power of the Turkish military. He has basically seized control of the country to some degree. He's in total control now. He's not likely to surrender it. The purges that have taken place are basically the disempowering of his opponent, and he is Turkey's version of Putin. Okay, the bare-chested strong man who basically unifies his country and holds it by not only by through his charisma, but through sheer force of will and the crushing of the opposition. Don't think that Erdogan does not suspect, even though he's not stated, but in some circles it has been stated, that coup was in some way orchestrated by his enemies here in the U.S. and by people sympathetic to that in Europe. So he's not looking at the United States or Europe at this point as being his favorite ally. He's looking to secure his position through a relationship with Russia. And at the same time, he's hoping that a strong relationship between Russia and Turkey forces the EU to accept him rather than oppose him, because it's better to have him in their corner than in Russia's corner, right?
I agree.
Now he's played a very strong hand.
Now, let me take a different angle, okay? Because every time we make a mess like we did in this situation, we need to come to the conclusion that we made mistakes, okay? The U.S.
Right.
made mistakes, and we have to agree and, get a grip with that and start coming to our senses to how we're going to solve it. Now, my position in this situation, for example, of Turkey, is that NATO is supposed to protect the democratic state of Turkey, not the emperor of Erdogan. You see, the idea that Erdogan is protected is bogus to me, because you cannot take over a regime, decide to be your omnipotent in your country in the middle of the mess, you know, the connection between Russia and, you know, the Europe and Syria and all the mess, and you become, you know, a totalitarian regime all of a sudden we have in Turkey, and nobody is coming to complain and say to him, listen, mister, you bring back your democratic state, if not, NATO needs to come to term with that. That's my position. Then you start recouping.
You know, I think you're right in that NATO is certainly better served when it supports democratic regimes that are its members. And Erdogan is straying away from democracy. You're right there. But here's something to consider. In recent years, regime change has not worked well for us. It didn't work well for us in Iraq. It's not working well for us in Syria. And it's not worked well in Libya. Right? Regime of the policy of regime change.
I understand. But let's look at the bigger picture. Let's look at the bigger picture, because we have Syria in play too. The fact of the matter is that all totalitarian regime are going to be dismantled in the Middle East. The people, they are tired to be enslaved. There is the democratic nation around them. There is the internet. They are aware of their condition. They are not going to sustain this kind of power anymore. That's why Gaddafi had to go. That's why Saddam Hussein had to go. And, you know, some bogus idea that, you know, Saddam was good for the country because he was holding them while killing 500,000 people a year. That's something that needs to be stopped, because I hear it in the news in America. They need to understand that the people of the region decided to, overcome their people, their controller, their emperor, whatever they call them. And America was the accessory. It helped them. Now we have Russia that come to play. Now, Russia wants to become an economic power. She doesn't want to become the military power. It's obvious. Now we need to agree with Russian. How are we going to sustain this change in the Middle East instead of trying to crash to each other?
So I want you to think about something, though, here. You're right that there's an undercurrent, right? It started in Egypt and in Tunisia and everything, where you had all of these young people take to the street and basically demand reform within the government. But here's what's missing, and this is really, you cannot overlook the importance of this. After World War II, right, we basically toppled Hitler in Germany, okay? We toppled the ruling regime in Japan and in Italy, correct? The Axis powers were all beheaded. Okay, right. And those countries recovered. But there were three important factors to consider. One, these were educated countries. They had literate population. We had a Marshall Plan that basically went in and rebuilt those countries over a period of time. And at no point did we dismantle the all of the structures of civil society. The people that basically ran the infrastructure basically stayed in place and served at the discretion of the occupying forces. In the Middle East, there is rampant illiteracy. The level of education is not what it was in Japan, Italy, or Germany. The majority of the population is very young. And the ruling structures that are there now are not only tribal but corrupt. And we have no viable partner that we can partner with to help bring stability to those countries. The third aspect of this is that you cannot overcome 3,000 years of culture with 15 years of war and occupation and misery.
Right.
So they're not in the same situation, and bringing stability to this region is going to be far more challenging than anything we've ever done in the past, and that's why this is the United States, it's the war in Afghanistan and Iraq is the longest war that ever in our history. And it is perhaps, if we're being really honest, and I'm a former military guy, you know, I spent 21 years in the military, and I've worked in the national security arena, but it's time for some honesty. We have a strategy in place that we hope will defeat an enemy that is not an enemy with whom we can actually negotiate, or that holds a broad powers that can actually bring stability or prosperity to its country. We don't have viable partners on the other side. And so there are all we have is options, or bad options, and worst scenario. There really are no good options for this region. And that being the case, we may actually have to take a little bit of we're going to have to take a humility pill, for one, and recognize that we can't solve all of the problems in the world. And the second thing we're going to have to do is we're going to have to make some compromises that are not what we would have, you know, accepted in the past. This is a really different situation. It's not like anything we've ever encountered in the past. And if we don't come to terms with that, then we just continue to fight unwinnable wars in the region, create more instability, okay? More and more countries and regimes start to fail, and the threats get greater over time. And not only that, but when you think of Israel, okay, Israel is better off with stable regimes in its backyard that it can actually negotiate with, rather than rogue terrorists, all with different motivations, that act don't act with unity of effort or purpose, and really can't be brought to the table and reasoned with. This is a very new situation. It's not like anything we've dealt with in the past.
I think that every challenge come with some answers, and one answer that I think that must be addressed at this point, because, you know, force, we had our share of force from all kind of countries, but let's assume that those people that are on the ground need assistance. There is no, you know, the United Nations doesn't play a role like it's supposed to be. All the NGOs don't play the role that they play of us, you know, to help them survive and get some safe zone. Because if we had some powerful civil movement that can help the people on the ground, because there are countries, you know, it's really easy to go fly over and, you know, drop some bombs and destroy its people life forever. But instead, we need to get, simple answers, but a very hard way to do. We have to build those nations. We have the responsibility to take those nations to the humanity we would like them to be, like they did everywhere else. You know, England went to South Africa. England went to India. England went to Israel, you know, but when it was Palestine and, you know, after the destruction, she started to rebuild it. There is no reason that we don't, you know, the people of the free world don't take a moment to decide how we're going to rebuild. We are talking about destruction all the time, and we forget that there are people involved in its countries and their life and in stakes. And we need to take off that road of battle and agree that we need to solve it. So we divide the task, we do the hard work, and, you know, and we turn the page on this moment in history. And all the rest will follow, you know, slowly but surely we'll get rid of those, you know, because ISIS, if you take them, you know, the supply, at the end of the day, you know, they cannot fight. If you position yourself in a place where you are helping a civilian, they cannot get involved. They can bomb a little, but after a while, we can catch them. You know, terrorists is not, you know, they don't rule the world. Right now, it sounds like they are running the world, and we need to take charge and decide to make a plan together, all of us, to make a better day.
I couldn't agree with you more, Orly. I think you're right. I think there are three issues here, right, that we have to really think about. One of them is the humanitarian issue, right? I mean, you have had millions of people displaced in Syria, okay? And almost 470,000 people killed are some of the estimates, and you have millions displaced in Syria. And all of those people that are displaced are looking for somewhere to go, and they're looking for someone to step in and, you know, help salvage what's left of their humanity. So I agree, there has to be a humanitarian effort. It has to be a global initiative, you know, of all the countries that have the military wherewithal, the economic wherewithal, to help support these people, and maybe, you know, help bring a safe zone. Right? Maybe we can create a safe zone within Syria that all parties can agree that within this safe zone we can put these refugees until a resolution is brought to the table, and, you know, take them out of harm's way. I would hope that we could do something like that, or at least have broad agreement between all of the member nations involved in this to do that.
John, we need to stop Turkey for trying to eliminate the Kurds. Remember, sometimes, you know, we are thinking and we're taking our sweet time when people's lives are in stake. They are trying to destroy the Kurds. And, you know, the Iraq zone, that a free area where they can battle all the time, must be, you know, reorganized in a normal way. And we need to push back those forces and come to terms with the fact that we cannot do it alone. We need Russia. And Russia, so far, she seems like Putin is trying to play it. He doesn't know the rules that we play in, but he's doing his best. And I'm sure that With his rule, you know, with his part, with our, you know, leadership, obviously, because we know the way, the American, you know, forces can come and be the peaceful forces instead of, you know, the combative one.
I would hope that Iran is facilitating these talks between Russia and Turkey, and some of the elements within the Syrian regime, Assad's force. I would hope that there would be a seat at the table for the United States, but I don't think that it will allow us to take the lead. I think they'll allow us to participate. And one of the realities here is, let's look at all the Sunni countries in the region, right? So think about it. Turkey is Sunni. Assad is an Alawite. But the problems he's having are with the Sunni within the country, because that's the opposition. Jordan is Sunni. Saudi Arabia is Sunni. Oman is Sunni. Bahrain and Qatar is Sunni. All of these countries have a vested interest, okay, in overthrowing Assad. But the big players, okay, that are really engaged here, Iran and Russia, want Assad to. And this is a real contentious point. The reality is that between Russia, Iran, and the United States, we have to create an environment in which there's, first thing we do is create a safe zone to stop the innocent people from being collateral damage.
Yeah, let's start with that.
The second thing we have to do is create a transition plan for Assad that does not involve disempowering him immediately, because I don't think that's going to happen. There's going to have to be some type of brokered deal.
Election.
In which the country is brought to stability, and then you have some type of coalition government come into power that helps to, you know, orchestrate stability, civil society, and a successful transition over time.
I agree. I think that the the word of today is we must take action and we must take responsibility, admit to our mistakes and the shortcoming and get to grip with the situation and get on. And the fact of the matter is we have no other choice. We have a no game, you know, like this is the moment that God is in control, said, this is it, guys, you need to get along. And that's a fantastic place to be in the universe, you know, where everybody must agree. If not, we all blow ourselves up, right? There is no other way.
Yeah. I hope that the better angels within our humanity can be brought to the table, and that some type of peaceful resolution can be implemented that will help reduce the loss of life in Syria, because the bulk of the people being hurt by this are innocent people. They are not enemy combatants. They are the collateral damage of, you know, a war, an ongoing war where there are different players that are
and it's devastating.
To maintain power.
And it's devastating for everybody, because millions of refugees, children that don't go to school, they are in camps, they are hungry, I heard, and their life are, you know, in shambles. And I pray for their soul, I pray for their life, I pray for this fast resolution. And I'm telling you, we have a lot of debate about who is going to be the next president. But we have a few months still until this, you know, president job is done. He might come with, you know, to the plate and make a really, really amazing contribution, because he has it in him. He can do it, because those two that we have to choose from, I don't know.
I agree with you. I think that there's a move that can be made by an American administration to help facilitate or expedite a peace or some type of ceasefire in Syria. But there's going to have to be compromise on all sides, and that includes us, if we're going to bring this about. And I think it's absolutely necessary. If you look at a map of the region, right, you think about it, Lebanon is not all that stable. Syria's inflamed. Iraq, to some degree, is totally destabilized. Jordan is being overwhelmed with refugees, right? And all of this happens to also border on, you know, Israel, okay?
Right.
It would be really good if we could bring about some type of ceasefire while we work through the issues of what the future of Syria is and what it will look like. But this president,
and you know, in all that, in all this mess, John, in all this mess that Jordan is holding, you know, having, the king decided to have a fit when yesterday, in the day of fasting, some people descend on Temple Mount, and you know, the risk of people, the Jewish people, praying. Is a high risk, high level of risk that might ignite a world war. You understand? If the Jewish people will decide to pray finally in the holy place for God of Israel, it will, you know, intrigue them to start all out war. That's craziness. Needs to stop. You know that.
Well, yes. I mean, I remember back in last March, when I was in Israel and I was leading that group of executives and we went to the Temple Mount, right? There was tremendous hostility exhibited by the Palestinian Authority on our Israeli escorts, who were scholars who were basically walking us through and giving us a tour of the Temple Mount. And you could read the hostilities were palpable. You could really feel them. And imagine the pressure that the King of Jordan is under at this very moment. So he's got these sprawling refugee centers, right, of these Syrians, of the Iraqis, all, you know, encamped in his territory. Not to mention some of the refugee, you know, situations he's had going on over years with the Palestinians, right? And so his country is in this, you know, Jordan is not a rich economy. So his country is basically depending on the handouts given by the international community to help sustain this. and they're trying to, you know, run, they're trying to maintain civil society within their territorial borders for their countrymen, while at the same time absorbing all of these refugees and all of the problems that these refugees are bringing with them. So this is not a good time for Jordan, and I'm sure that there's some posturing taking place by people within his own country who have a more fundamentalist view of what the root of these problems are, right?
And that's why I'm coming back to the idea, the whole idea. You know, every faith has its own idea of the end of time or whatever we have to achieve to be an achiever. Like, you know, in America, we have the dream, American dreams that we all dream of. You know, the Jewish religion is a dream of peace. They have all kind of analogy, but the peaceful symbol to the day that it will happen is by building a house of God for everybody on Temple Mount. And this house will bring so much prosperity. And, you know, if you go back in the Bible, time of Solomon, it was the richest of all time ever in the Middle East, because people come together. They agree to agree with each other. They make commerce. They make businesses. They come to pray together. It doesn't matter who you are and where you come from. You're all welcome in one place. And that was the harmony that the world, it's like the equilibrium that the world needs. And it's in Jerusalem and it's biblical. And for some reason, the king of Jordan think that, you know, he is entitled to the whole holy shrines when he's only entitled to the mosque. You know, the mosques are holy, but the other acreage, it's like, you know, you're taking a place, you buy a house, and you decide that all the garden and the parks around it, it belongs to you. You cannot. It's only you have a special condition on the holy shrines, but the rest is must be open to everybody. That's where you visit it, then you see that it's not. And we are complaining that in all this mess that they have, they decide to come and complain that some Jewish people walk the Temple Mount.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It really is. Right. It's ridiculous. It's tragic and it's provocative, right? I mean,
right.
It's the holy site of all three of the Abrahamic faiths, right? Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And it should be a place where all three faiths can meet in peace and express fellowship and respect for one another. And yet, you know, this is what's taking place here, this hostility. It's provocative because all sides have deeply seated passions about not only their faith, but their right to practice and worship their faith on that site. This is something that, I mean, it's been ongoing ever since the founding of Israel, right?
But when they talk peace, they have not found
a reasonable path forward on this.
I pray
that in the future we can.
That's why Benjamin Netanyahu insisted that they accept the Jewish state. They don't want to accept the Jewish nation. It means that they have a problem with God of Israel for some reason, where is, you know, Abraham is the father of everybody, is the patriarch of all three religions, and we all brother at the end of the day. You understand that? And it's like the brother, the half-brother, of course, that decided he doesn't accept. And they, you know, they are imam that talk to me on, you know, on the internet, and they say that, you know, the Jewish people invented the Judaism, which you know, it's ludicrous because it's the first in this. It started all from Judaism, so we need to address that, because once we start with a basic peaceful agreement of, you know, coexistence, we're talking coexistence. We're not taking over each other, coexistence. Then we can spread some kind of understanding to the rest of the world. But if they are signing a paper, then they don't comply. Why to blame Israel after that she doesn't come to the table to negotiate? Negotiate with what?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's a lack of reason right, on behalf of when it comes to discussions on the Temple Mount. I mean, you really don't see the type of hostility on the Wailing Wall, right, on the side controlled by Israel that you see on the side administered by the Palestinian Authority, by the Jordanian Authority.
Jordanian.
You really don't see the same level of hostility. And it really is time, I think, to have a more honest conversation about, you know, how they can bring about some type of agreement that opens it up, makes it accessible, and reduces the level of tension.
UNESCO, the United Nations body, decided it wanted to make a session to decide the Temple Mount doesn't have any clues or any, the Jewish people have no rights on the Temple Mount. They're trying to scrape the history of the Jewish and the Christianity all at once and give it to the Muslim, where they are the last in line, you know, because the Islam came after. And
that's all politically motivated. I mean, none of that is rooted in any type of historical fact or accuracy, right? It's all politically motivated.
Well, the Bible is a book that everybody preserved for thousands of years. The Bible is a book that everybody cherishes, and you know, you open it again and again, and it's always the same. It's not that it changes. And this is let's assume that it's the historical lesson that humanity brings with it. It's not. It's the road to happiness, and we need to use it sometime, I guess. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, there's a saying, right, by people who perish for lack of knowledge, right? And
right.
I think that's a big problem on, you know, unfortunately, in every faith, is people embrace the faith and then don't stop to really study or understand its principles and its application to all of humanity.
That's true. But we have to understand that we need to love each other, accept each other. If we start there, we might come farther. And, you know, I believe in humanity, and I trust in God that he'll guide us to really make this world better. And, John, with you in this world, we're all thankful for, you know, for a gift that God gave us to have you around us to help us and guide us. Your family is extraordinary. I love them all. They are beautiful. And your friends that you so kindly brought together to visit Israel and Jerusalem were, you know, received very well, and they are always welcome, and you're welcome to come back anytime. Actually, we would like you to come back, and we invite you again so we can make a really big summit, you know, for the anniversary of the liberation of Jerusalem next year, 2017. And then we have, a hope that by then the region will settle and we'll start giving the children of Syria, Jordan, Iraq, and Turkey, and all around, some hope, happiness, and good life. All right?
Orly, from your lips to God's ears. And you know,
amen.
What? You and I are going to make that trip happen next year. We'll talk about it some more, because every time I bring the group to Israel, and especially the way you host us is extraordinary. Everybody comes back having, you know, learned so much. It's a paradigm shifting trip, but we'll make this trip happen for 2017, and we definitely want to be there for that. And hopefully, they say next year in Jerusalem,
God willing,
we'll make that happen. You know,
amen.
God bless you,
amen.
And thank you for having me.
That would be lovely. That would be lovely. John, sweetheart, thank you so much for coming on the show. God bless you. You know, you are a terrific guy. May always your road will be happy and, you know, smooth, and, you know, help us through this time. Thank you so much for coming.
Likewise, Orly. Take care.
God bless you. Ciao, ciao. Bye-bye. All right, you guys. Let's get some music, and we'll be back after that.
If I have to beg, plead for your sympathy, I don't mind, 'cause you mean that much to me. Ain't too proud to beg, sweet darling, please don't leave me, girl.
Don't you go.
Ain't too proud to plead, baby, baby, please don't leave me, girl.
Don't you go.
Now I heard a crying man is half the man. Surprise, but if I have to cry to keep you, I don't mind weeping, whoa, whoa, just to keep you by my side. Ain't too proud to beg, sweet darling, please don't leave me, girl. Ain't too proud, baby, baby, please don't leave me, girl. If I have to sleep on your doorstep all night and day, I can stay, 'cause I'm gonna keep you any way I can. Ain't too proud to beg, don't leave me, girl. Ain't too proud to plead, baby, baby, please don't leave me, girl. Ooh, oh yeah, well,
All right, we are back. It's Orly Benny Davis. That song is dedicated to the president. It was one of his lists, and I hope they enjoy it. We have a really, really incredible time in history, and I'm really hoping and praying for the players of this time to come and do their job, and not the job because it's, you know, they are paid for it, because the pay is not really much. It's because they've been bestowed upon the responsibility of this universe, which is much grander, to be a part of a historical movement of peace and a changing from war to a new day. You know, this is, let's say, usher the new age. And while I was talking to John, I mentioned the fact that Russia does not want to be a fighter, wants to be a player, economic player. And I all the moves are, you know, indicating that he's doing that. Let's listen to what he's doing with England now.
Well, with friendship seemingly restored between Turkey and Russia, Moscow could now be set to take on a more ambitious diplomatic project, attempting to mend ties with the UK. This week, Vladimir Putin and Theresa May spoke on the phone for the first time since the new British Prime Minister took office in July. Both claim that they're unhappy with the current state of relations and agreed to meet face-to-face at the G20 summit next month in China. The phone call comes as relations have hit a low between the two nations. However, it seems common challenges like the threat of terror could force Moscow and London to unite. We spoke to political commentator John White about the prospect of a new beginning.
For both countries, it's very important that their relations get off to a new start in light of Theresa May's assumption of power in Downing Street. It's very important for Britain in the sense that Theresa May has assumed the reins of government in Downing Street at a time of deep economic and political uncertainty in the UK in light of the Brexit vote. And obviously they have things in common they need to deal with. They need to deal with events in the Middle East with regards to the ongoing struggle against ISIS. And Russia will be keen to try and affect some kind of change in attitude vis-a-vis NATO expansion and encirclement. So they both have very, very serious issues to deal with. And it's about time that they understood that, that it's better to do so united rather than disunited.
Well, the two leaders' names have rarely been seen together in the media before Theresa May became Prime Minister. References in the past have been combative and somewhat strange. Here's an extract from a sketch piece in Britain's Guardian newspaper, which joked Putin would rather tickle Theresa May to death than poison her. That's referring to the case of the former Russian Secret Service agent Alexander Litvinenko, who was poisoned in London in 2006. Another article from the UK press claims that Putin will be as equally challenging as Brexit for May. And this one, just after the PM's appointment, suggested the Russian leader would seek to make friends with the UK.
All right, we are back. It's Orly Benny Davis with The Impossible Truth. You know, guys, I think that Russia and England making some economical decision together actually may help England with the Brexit, because the European Union are stubborn to decide that until they trigger Article 50 that ignite the Brexit to a two-year term, to make any kind of agreement with the European Union, while they are stubborn enough to hold, you know, their horses, the Russian come and play. You know, that's something, it's incredible in this game, because if somebody's doing something good, we need to approach it with some sort of credibility. Of course, we have the history to remember, and I'm sure England is that the one that needs to be taught any kind of lesson of history. She makes it and build it and create it, and she knows what they're doing. And Theresa May, God bless her, I'm sure that she's smart enough, if she's leading such a great nation, to lead a good agreement and transitional from relationship with Russia while she's exiting from the European zone. And one thing I want to put in play and thought about negotiation of any deal agreements with the European Union. You know, European Union are really at their standoff with Russia on Ukraine. Remember the situation with the Ukraine started all because the European Union wanted Ukraine to become a part of it. Now that England is off the European Union, it doesn't push, the wrong button to the Russian. So England can create some kind of relationship. And the European Union needs to resettle back to the mode that, European Union is not going to be at the border of Russia. Sensitive matter, sensitive information, but I'm sure that we're all big people now and old enough to understand that we better start moving and doing something good instead of something bad will happen, because there is no other way. You take it, you build it, and you free yourself from, England, free yourself from European tie. And that, antidote that I wanted to bring before about the fact that the European Union insists that the free travel will be implemented to all travelers from European Union to England and vice versa in order for them to make any kind of agreement, commercial agreement, which is, if I understood it correctly, it's odd because America makes with the European Union a lot of business and they don't have the right to travel in America. So that article that stated that, you must facilitate, free entry, like the Turks, they want free entry to Europe, which is bogus. You cannot do that. You cannot allow it. You need to hold your country. It's not the zoo. It's like an open apartment, You can have it for a certain period of time of emergency, but to live with that, it cannot be. So the Turks needs to go back on their request. The European Union needs to go back to their request if we want to make sense of it. And I'm talking about it like I'm in the middle of it. I'm just watching, and maybe from outside you can see stuff that you don't from inside, because the bubble is really a bubble. You don't see much. But I trust that you understand that we are coming with the best intention. My only intention is to build a house of God to everybody else. That's my hidden agenda, so-called. So for all the rest, I like commerce, I like visiting, I like freedom, and I think that good music will do that. So let's listen to some more music.
This is something called You Do Something to Me. Something to me, something deep inside. I'm hanging on the wire.
All right. This, you know, it's been an incredible day yesterday when we were fasting, praying to God to build a temple for humanity, for everybody to come together. And I do hope and I do believe that one day soon we will sit together and understand. You know, when we run into each other in the street, we never have any hostility. Just if it's, you know, in a certain place when you know that the party is different from you. But the truth of the matter, right now we have incredible display of sportsmanship in Brazil. The Olympic been, thank God, going very, very well considering all the incredible challenge they had to cope with, security and a lot of devastation from the Zika virus. And we saw some moments in history that really will be recorded. And through the all challenging, you know, the American guy was winning gold medal one moment, and the next moment he was gunned down, you know, with somebody was trying to just take their, you know, money, and he saved his life and he understood what is important. And Mr. Phelps, that the guy that's won so many medals of gold, he come to the plate with the hands that he wants to serve the humanity. And we're calling upon all those people of sports. Give us the example. Give the children the example. Pretend, you know, that you are it for them. Understand that you are the mentor. You can increase their value in life when they understand that sports and sportsmanship is so important for mankind. And the world is blessed with so many great athletes. And I want to thank them all for the incredible efforts that they took, and what a wonderful performance they show us. It was intriguing. It was exhilarating. And it gave us a lot of happiness and trust that humanity can overcome a lot of challenges. So I trust in them, I trust in you, and I trust in God to help us all through this time. We're going to make it. Just remember, we're going to make it to the other side of these days. And we're going to turn the page on history when we're all going to sit down and eat couscous together, eat the, you know, Middle Eastern food and European food and Australian and English, American, everything together, because we deserve each other. This is a world, and this is the only world we have. God bless you all. I'll talk to you next week. I'll miss you till then. God bless you. Be well. Behave, okay? Be good. Be good. And Russia, we love you. America, please lead us through this. God bless you. Ciao, ciao.